Dave here around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truthtoyou.org. That's truth2u.org. It is season two of Torah Pills. I'm Jono, and being that it is the holiday season, and they say that a change is as good as a holiday, today's program has some surprise guests. Joining me in the virtual Truth To You studio all the way from Louisiana is Ross Nichols of rootsoffaith.org. That's rootsoffaith.org. G'day, mate.
Shalom, shalom. How are you, Jonah?
Doing very well, my friend. It's very exciting to have you on the program. And in my hometown of Sydney, Australia, is the rabbi of Newtown Synagogue, the director of Jews for Judaism in Australia. The website is jewsforjudaism.org.au. That's jewsforjudaism.org.au. Welcome to the program, Rabbi Eli Cohen.
Thank you, Jono, for being such a dedicated host.
It's so exciting to have you guys, both you guys, on the program at once. I really am very, very excited. Long-time listeners will remember Rabbi Eli Cohen from the A Jewish Perspective series that we did, which is still extremely popular, featured a couple of those in the top 60 for the year, and have already received hundreds of hits since I floated them just a number of days ago. Very popular you are, my friend. And of course, Ross, you and I are going on tour together with Rabbi Tovia Singer. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later as well. That's coming up in November. There are still seats available. You can find details on truthtoyou.org. Before we talk about any of that, Rabbi Eli Cohen, let me just explain to everybody. You and I are in the future.
Okay.
I can't wait to hear this.
Not only is 2015 the year that Back to the Future was set in, but we're in it already, whereas you, Ross, you're not there yet. Rabbi Eli Cohen and I are a year ahead of you.
Oh, well, that makes it all the worthwhile. I'm so glad. What does it look like over in 2015?
Oh, it's pretty warm here, isn't it? How is it in Sydney? I mean, you did the fireworks last night, Rabbi Eli Cohen.
I did the fireworks. I'm a very spontaneous kind of guy, and I just decided, you know what, let's just do it. And we.
What was it like?
It was fantastic. We drove to the city, and you know, I had no idea where I was going. I just drove, and the city was blocked off by a certain street. So I just, you know, I made a right, and I turned in, and I just followed the street. I made a left here and a right there, and I ended up finding a parking spot.
You're kidding.
Finding a parking spot, 2-hour parking, no need to pay because it was up till 6 p.m. and parking right next to the steps that lead up to Lady Macquarie Chair.
Oh, which is right on the harbour. I have to just tell everybody, that is unheard of. You don't just go out, because there was 1.6 million people on the harbour to go and see this spectacular fireworks display that is New Year's Eve every year in Sydney. 1.6 million people. Rabbi Eli Cohen just gets in his car. He goes down here. He goes down there. He turns there. He finds a park. It's 2 hours parking. No worries. Doesn't have to pay. It's all good. That's unheard of.
And, you know, it's all in the merit of your wife and your children. That's just the way it works. You know, God helps those who try to take care of their family. That's what I believe. And it was really, really amazing. We went there. We weren't able actually to get all the way up to Lady Macquarie Chair. We stayed in the Royal Botanical Gardens, I think that's what it's called. It was still an amazing view of the fireworks. People were camped out there. It was really, really nice. Now, I just want to say that I've been asked by a lot of people on Facebook, do you celebrate the pagan New Year? And you know, do you engage in pagan practices? Mm. And, you know, heaven forbid, we don't celebrate anything pagan whatsoever. However, here in Australia, we live in a secular society, fortunately or unfortunately, however you see it. But that's the way it is. And here in Australia, they spend millions of dollars on a firework display to kick off the secular year, really. It's not really religious mm-hmm. anymore. It's a secular year. And it's an opportunity for people to get close to their family and to go out and enjoy spending time together with the people who they love most. And that's what we did. And there's nothing un-Jewish or pagan about it.
Listen, it's millions of dollars of taxpayers' money going up in smoke. If you're a taxpayer, you ought to at least enjoy the show, right? That's what I reckon. Now, Russ, you've had similar questions, haven't you?
Actually, I have. But I have put that aside to be on the phone with two of my wonderful friends, because You might even hear fireworks in the background. Where I live, it is 10 p.m., so we're approaching that hour when we enter into this 2015 on the Gregorian calendar. So if you hear the fireworks, we can either say that that's what's going on, or perhaps that people are celebrating the fact that we're all together here tonight talking about the Torah. Maybe that's what they're doing.
That's probably right. And, you know, it's very important to mention today for all your Jewish listeners, especially those who are, well, all over the world, because it is tonight in America, today here in Australia, the 10th day of the month of Tevet, which is actually a fast day. And while I was out with my kids, they said they wanted to say passages of Torah because, you know, although we're out watching fireworks, but it is the 10th day of Tevet, and they felt that it was important to discuss Torah while we were out there in Royal Botanical Gardens. So, yeah, so that was that's important. Now, what happened on the 10th day of Tevet is this is when the king of Babylonia surrounded the walls of Jerusalem, and this was like the beginning of the end for the temple, the destruction of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And so therefore it is a very sad day for us, and you know, it's a day when we fast. We don't eat from dawn until nightfall. Tonight here in Sydney, that's about at 8:38 is when you can eat. And it's a time for reflection. It's a time to think about what we can do to transform this world into a world that God, that wouldn't be pleasing to God, and ultimately bring about all the future promises, some of them which are actually mentioned in this week's portion, in this week's Torah portion, which talks about the end of days. And we hope that this happens speedily.
It might happen soon. Now, while we're talking about that, Jews for Judaism, you have a new office in Bondi, is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, I'm the rabbi in Newtown Synagogue, and my kids learn over in Bondi, and it's about a half an hour drive every day there and back. And what I was doing is going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, because I pray there as well during the week. And it just became too much. It's so time-consuming, the drive. I'd rather have somewhere where I can just drop off my kids, pray, and then go and work right nearby, and then I don't have to go back and forth and back and forth. And I managed to find a place here in Bondi Junction. There's a Jewish law firm over here, and they offered me a small office. It's nothing fancy, and they gave me a very reasonable price, and I decided I've got to take it. And so I took it, even though it means an extra financial commitment. But nevertheless, it means more work getting done, and that's what's most important.
But you are running a fundraiser at the moment, and you were also asking for, just correct me if I'm wrong, you were asking for volunteers, right?
Well, it started me asking for volunteers, but although I appreciate volunteers, there's also some consistency in paid workers. And so I've got a part-time secretary that I've now hired, and it's amazing how much work I actually get done when I have somebody else actually working with me, making sure to get everything done. And yes, it is an extra expense, but I can't begin to say how much extra I'm able to do because of it.
That's great.
Yeah, anyway, so
well, how can people participate in the fundraiser? Where can they go?
Well, it's really a virtual fundraiser that's happening on Facebook. But really, it's just a matter of encouraging people to go to Jews for Judaism website and clicking on the donate page, and you can donate either with a credit card or via PayPal. And both of them are via PayPal. But if you have a PayPal account, you can donate via PayPal with your account. Excellent. Or you can, on the left-hand side, it says if you don't have a PayPal account, you can continue by clicking on a button over there or on a link over there which says to continue, and then you can put in your credit card details and you can donate. And, you know, every dollar counts. And, you know, if I just have, you know, 25,000 people, just give me $1 each, I'll be fine.
You'll be good. There it is. So what I'll do is I'll put a link on this post so that people can do that in not just in appreciation for the time that you're giving us today at such short notice, but for the other programs which have been so very, very popular. And if you do, dear listener, go to truthtoyou.org and just go to the search engine and type in Rabbi Eli Cohen. You'll get those what's called a Jewish Perspective series that he did that were ever so popular and so very, very helpful. Now, Ross, what's going through your mind, my friend? Shall we begin?
I tell you, I am so ready. I was thinking about one of the things that I love about the Torah is that even though this particular Torah portion records both the death of Yaakov as well as the death of Yosef, it begins, like so many things that we learn within Judaism, Vayihi. It's really about life, and it begins with this idea that Jacob lives for 17 years with Yosef, the ending 17 years, and he also lived the first 17 years of his life. I'm not sure of the significance. Maybe Rabbi Eli Cohen might provide some insight on that. I just think it's interesting.
That is curious. Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying. It was Joseph was 17 when he was sold into slavery. Is that what you're saying? And that when Jacob saw Joseph again as the two I see in Egypt,
yep,
if you like, he lived for another 17 years. Is there a significance there, Rabbi Eli Cohen?
Most definitely. In Hebrew, every single Hebrew letter has a numerical value. It's called a gematria. And so Aleph, being the first letter, has the numerical value of 1, base 2, gimel 3, and so on. So if you take the word vayichi and you add it up, you've got 6 plus 10, 16, plus 8, plus 10, which equals, come on.
But you're asking me, I'm not going to.
I was waiting for him to give the answer.
Don't give me mathematical equations. I thought you're sitting there with a calculator. What is it?
No, it's 34. And so that's
17 and 17.
And that's 17 and 17. And what it's telling us is that the best years of Jacob's life were the years that he spent together with Joseph. And interestingly enough, the number 17 is also the numerical value for the Hebrew word tov, good, meaning the good years of his life, the best years of his life, he spent together with Joseph. And there's a lot to be said about that, because one would have to ask themselves, how is it possible that for 17 years, right, that Jacob was living outside of the land of Israel, living in the diaspora, in Egypt of all places, could he have years that can truly be considered good? How can he have good years outside of the land? And the answer to that was given last week in last week's Torah portion, where it says that that Jacob sent Yehuda. He sent Judah ahead of him. He sent him to Goshenah. And what did he send him to Goshenah ahead of him for? And so what we're told in the Jewish commentaries is that he sent him ahead to set up a yeshiva, to set up a house of study, so that while they would be in Egypt, they would be preoccupied with the study of Torah. And when you're preoccupied with the study of Torah, it doesn't matter where you are in the world. You can have the best life, because it is a life occupied with studying God's word, studying the Torah.
You know, Jonah, one thing I wanted to add, I think that's some great insight on the number 17 and how the best years of his life were spent with Yosef. In last week's Torah portion in Vayeshev, in Genesis 47:9, Yaakov, when he goes before Pharaoh, he says, "The days of the years of my residence are 130 years. The days of the years of my life have been few and bad." You know, it's like he looks back on all the things that he's lived through, and that assessment is quite startling. But then to hear this, the 17 years with Yosef, both at the beginning and the end, are really quite incredible, I think.
And it's I guess, comforting, too, because when he finally gets to see his son again, thinking that he was dead for so many years, and finally gets it, he's talking as if he's ready to die. He's at least, you know, "I will go and see my son Joseph, and he will put his hands on my eyes, and I'm ready to die." But he lives for another 17 years, and that's a beautiful thing. And that's the way that our Torah portion begins. And it goes on. And one thing that I find interesting in this Torah portion is the going back and forth of referring to Jacob as Jacob, and then only a sentence later referring to him as Israel. Verse 29 is no exception. It says that when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Now, if I found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. You shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." Oh, now, Ross, their burial place. I'm very excited about this. You've made me excited about this. Why is that?
I tell you, this is so exciting. In fact, in this Torah portion, there are three references to this idea of don't bury me in Egypt, but in the tomb of the fathers. And of course, we know that from the Torah as Machpelah in Hebron, the tomb of the patriarchs. And so tying this to our tour to Israel, what I think is so interesting is that we will be in the land of Israel for Torah portion Chayei Sarah. And we have actually planned, the listeners may not know this, but we've actually planned to be in Hebron at the Tomb of the Patriarchs on Erev Shabbat, on the Friday, actually before Erev Shabbat. We're going to go by the Tomb of the Patriarchs and then spend Shabbat in Jerusalem. So we will be there that particular Shabbat, and I'm excited about that.
I have to say that when we were discussing this with Tobia, I didn't realize the gravity of that which you just explained, Ross. And when we told Tobia, it was as if his eyeballs popped out of his head.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't believe the timing by which we are planning to be there. This is what we are certainly endeavoring to do, people. And there's still some seats on the bus. Don't delay, because this is something you don't want to miss. Rabbi Eli Cohen, what's going through your mind, my friend?
What's going through my mind is that in Israel, if I'm not mistaken, there's only 2 weeks throughout the entire calendar year that the Israeli authorities allow for a major event at Hebron, and that is in the portion of Chayei Sarah and the portion of Vayechi, where those are the references in the Jewish scriptures to the place of the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, where our ancestors are buried. And, you know, back in 1997, now that's a long time ago, when I was studying in Israel, I spent Parshas Chayei Sarah in Hebron for that Shabbos, and it was the most amazing experience.
Oh, can you tell us a little bit about that?
It all comes together as one big haze. It was just amazing. The people, the Jewish people that live there, are the most amazing people you'll ever meet. They live with daily self-sacrifice. They are the most amazing hosts ever. They live selflessly, and they're just unbelievable. And you know, we also got a bit of action while we were there. There was a little bit of rioting, and you know, the kids living there seem to be used to it.
Wow!
But it was amazing to be able to be there to be in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. I think they even allow you to go up to the resting place of Isaac, which is usually closed off. But you'll have to double check. I don't know what it's like now.
I think that's true in that Rabbi Singer also said that this is one of those rare occasions when you can have access to that.
Right. So yeah, it really truly is amazing to, you know, to go back and to come into a physical place where our ancestors walked, our ancestors lived. Remember that Hebron is also extremely significant to King David. So it was kind of like his city for a long time. And so, yeah, it's amazing to be able to actually be there and to take in everything that's there. So, you know,
this is what we're certainly endeavoring to do. I'm so excited. I'm beside myself just hearing you talk about it as well. But this is on the itinerary of the Tanakh tour. And again, listeners, you can find the details on truthtoyou.org. You'll see the page there. Just click on it. It'll give you the details as to how you can secure your seat. But don't delay. It goes on. Chapter 48, it says, "Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, 'Indeed, your father is sick.' And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, 'Look, your son Joseph is coming to you.' And so Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph," now I've got, Rabbi Eli Cohen, I've got in my Bible here, and I'm reading from a Christian translation, the New King James Study Bible I have, and it says, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz." But that's not what it says in the Hebrew. It says El Shaddai. What is the significance of El Shaddai? What does it mean?
That's a good question. God has different names throughout Scripture that refer to the way God interacts with the world. And when we speak about the name of El Shaddai, it usually is speaking about God, the way He manifests Himself in a powerful display. And so, quite often, when we see this name being used by God, it's a reference to show how although many times we look at nature and we just see things happening as if it's part of nature. There are certain times when there's a display where we see there's somebody clearly in control, there's somebody clearly doing things. And for Yaakov, it was a matter of saying, look, here, God, who is the all-powerful one, who is the only one that has the ability to bless and to see through the blessings, he's the one that appeared to me, and he's the one to bless me. And so it's significant to remember that Jacob is telling not just Joseph, but he's telling all of us that we can look around at the world, and we can often become... afraid of what does the future hold for me? And, you know, yes, there are promises in the Bible, but, you know, how do we know what's going to happen? Jacob tells us, don't worry. God, who is the all-powerful one, he's the one that blessed me. He will see through his blessings to the end. And so that's what I believe the significance is here.
Russ?
No, I love this ancient name. You know, in Torah portion Vayirah, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, there's this passage in Shemot chapter 6 where it actually says that I appeared to Avraham, to Yitzhak, and to Yaakov as El Shaddai. And so this ancient patriarchal name has a lot of significance. And I think, as I work through patriarchal narratives, I like to think about that passage from Vayirah.
And I think the first time we see it, my memory serves me correctly, I think it's Genesis chapter 17, verse 1. With Abraham there. So it is, it's very interesting. And it says, behold, Jacob says to Joseph, God Almighty, El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting, everlasting possession. Love that. And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. So he's saying, these are mine now. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Your offspring, whom you beget after them, shall be yours, and they will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. That's a little bit of a tongue twister to understand. You have to read that a number of times. Ross, what goes through your mind there?
A couple of things strike me right away. One of the things, just if you look carefully at the language, in chapter 48, verse 4, it says, I'm making you fruitful and multiplying, and I'll make you. These are the words of Hashem. If you look back at Genesis 35:11, presumably what he's talking about, in 35:11, he says, and God said to him, I am El Shaddai, be fruitful and multiply. Now, it's interesting, and maybe you might have a comment on this, but in 35:11, it's almost like a command. Be fruitful and multiply, whereas in 48:4, he says, I'll make you fruitful and multiply you. I just think that difference in language probably has more significance than I know right now.
Rabbi Eli Cohen, what is there a deeper significance?
Well, often there are times when we are commanded to go out and make our own effort, and there are times where we're told that there's nothing left for you to do. I'll do the rest. So when it comes to going out and having children, even in an unsafe world, a world where we're not so sure about what will be with these children, God tells us you have an obligation to bring children into this world. You have an obligation to do your best, to do your part. And what happens is you become a partner with me, God says, and together we make man. Together we will produce something good and beneficial for the world. And so the difference would be that before Yaakov goes out and has children and tries to build a house, God tells him, go and do it, even though you cannot be sure of what will be. I'm telling you, you should go out and do it. And once Yaakov's done it, God tells him, I will see to it that I'll do the rest, so to speak. Mm-hmm. As if, you know, you're not sure what's going to be, but I promise you that it's going to actually succeed. You know, it's interesting that in Isaiah chapter 59, I think it is, verse 21, when God makes a covenant with the Jewish people, telling them that my word and my spirit, which I've placed in your mouth, shall not be removed from you or from your children or your children's children, says the Lord. And it's a promise that God makes to the Jewish people, that although you can invest everything you have in your children and you still won't be assured by your own might that they will turn out okay and that they will continue on in the way of God. God promises that you do your part and he'll do his part to make sure that his words and his spirit don't depart from their mouths. And that's really a promise to Jacob. And you know what's interesting? Brilliant. What's interesting is if you just go a bit further, I don't want to, you can come back, but in chapter 48, verse 15, right, what happens is it says that Vayivarech es Yosef, and he blessed Yosef. This is Yaakov blessing Yosef. And when we keep reading, right, into verse 16, it says, and then the angel who redeemed me from all evil shall bless the lands Manasseh and Ephraim. And, you know, that's kind of strange, because here it is, Yaakov blessing Joseph. But instead of blessing Joseph, he's blessing his two children, Manasseh and Ephraim. Yeah. But in essence, this was the bracha to Yosef. The bracha to Yosef is that his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, should be righteous people. That when a person is blessed, that his children should continue on in being loyal to God. That is the greatest blessing.
And I love the passage in Isaiah that you quoted, Rabbi Eli. It says, and this shall be my covenant with them. You know, it goes on, my spirit which is upon you and the words which I've placed in your mouth. When it starts off and it says, Zot Briti, this is my covenant. That is really, truly powerful that represents the covenant, the spirit and the words placed on the mouth.
Indeed. And so it goes on to talk about the passing of Rachel, that Rachel is buried in Bethlehem. We are hoping and intending to also visit her tomb as well, I do believe, Ross, when
That's
we're
right.
on tour.
That's right. We talked about making that stop as well.
That is going to be such a packed day. And it goes on, when Israel saw Joseph's sons, after he's just claimed them and said, they're mine, he said, who are these guys? That seems a little bit odd. And you know what? It reminds me, Rabbi Eli Cohen, this reminds me, of course, of Jacob's father, Isaac, Yitzhak. His eyes were also failing in his latter years. And because of that, Jacob was able to gain the firstborn inheritance by deceit, impersonating his brother. And here we see that Israel sees Joseph's sons and he says, who are these? Is he just confirming, remembering what he did?
So, it's according to the Jewish commentaries, what happened is that when Israel, when that's Jacob, when he saw the sons of Yosef, what happens is that the Holy Spirit, the Ruach HaKodesh, the Shekhinah that rested with Joseph, with Yaakov, departed from him. And the reason for this that's given is because from Manasseh and Ephraim actually come Yeravam and Achav, who come from Ephraim. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, something happened, and that bewildered Yaakov and said, well, what's going on? You know, obviously, if the Shekhinah departs from me, perhaps they're not deserving of having the blessings. And you know, ultimately, they do get the blessings, notwithstanding who their descendants will be. And you know, the other one is Yehu and his children that were also descendants of Manasseh. So ultimately, he does end up blessing them. But because of the loss of the feeling of the inspiration, he was worried that maybe there was something wrong with them themselves.
Interesting. And so Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons with God, with whom God has given me in this place." And he said, "Please bring them to me, and I will bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age that he could not see. And then Joseph brought them near to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, "I had not thought to see your face, but in fact God has shown me your offspring." And so Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left hand, Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right, and brought them near to him. Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger. and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, is what it says. For Manasseh was the firstborn, and he blessed Joseph and said, God, before, as you said, Rabbi Likon, God, before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who fed me all my life long to this day, the messenger, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them, and the name of my father Abraham and Isaac, let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, when Joseph saw that his father had laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, and it displeased him, and so he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "No, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, son, I know. And he shall also become a people, and he shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." Now, Ephraim, I think we're talking about, what's his name?
Joshua.
Thank you. Joshua. And Samuel, right?
When it says that the younger one is going to be greater than the older one, it's referring to Joshua, who's going to come out, and he's going to actually settle the people into the land and teach them and teach Torah to the Jewish people. And nevertheless, he also makes reference to the fact that the Manasseh will also be great. And over here, this is a reference to Gideon, who comes from Manasseh.
So one of the things, I just as a comment, I think your translation, Jono, said that he guided his hands knowingly.
Knowingly.
And in the Hebrew, from my limited understanding, that the word there is sikel, which it looks like that the root is to understand, to have insight. It's almost, so the guiding is very interesting in the translation, because it's almost like he has some sort of understanding, though chapter 48, verse 10 says that he's not able to see, like physically he can't see, but perhaps spiritually he's led to cross his hands like that.
It's interesting. I'm looking over here at the Targum to chapter 48, I think it is verse 14, and it says, he moved his left hand on the hand of Manasseh, and he did it with chokhmah, with wisdom.
Uh-huh.
With wisdom. So it is kind of guided and with wisdom that he swapped his hands over.
Now, verse 19 does end with his descendants, Ephraim's descendants, shall become a multitude of nations.
Ephraim will be Melo Hagoyim.
Now that being the case, I mean, we've mentioned Joshua, we've mentioned Samuel, also the first king of the northern of Israel, and then 10 Israel was scattered into the nations. Is this what it's perhaps referring to? Ross, what's your thoughts there?
Well, one of the things I was thinking, you know, the importance of Ephraim can't be understated, especially through the prophecies. One of the things that I always think about when I think about Ephraim is in Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 7 through 9, and then also in verse 20, there's this interesting reference. You know, a lot of people in my culture or where I come from have this certain understanding of God's son. But we know from the Torah, from Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, that Israel is God's son and his firstborn. And then in Jeremiah 31, there's this reference to Ephraim as being the firstborn. And I always think about that when I think about Ephraim. You know, who is Ephraim? Well, it's very clear in Jeremiah 31, "Should I forget my son, my darling," I think is the King James.
Wow. And so he blessed them that day, saying, "By you, Israel will bless," saying, "May God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." And thus he said, Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brothers." Now, here's a curious verse here, Rabbi Eli Cohen. It goes on to say, "which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow." What is in that? What is that in reference to? Do you know?
That's in reference to what took place in Shechem when Shimon and Levi went out against the people of Shechem. And, you know, what happened was they went out to war against them.
Because of Dina.
Yeah, because of Dina. And because, well, it wasn't just because of Dina. It was actually, there was an attempt over there to try and have Jacob and his family assimilate. And that was something that they weren't going to have any part of. When it says that he took from the hands of the Amorite, it's referring to the hand of Esav. And what does Emori mean in Hebrew? Emori comes from the word emor, like to say, to speak. And Esav was referred to like an Emori because he used to trick and slight his father with his speech. He would pretend as if he was living the way that Isaac wanted him. In fact, the rabbinic commentary say that he would ask him, you know, whether he needs to tithe salt. And so, you know, Isaac was led to believe by Esau that his son was all pious and righteous, and therefore he's called Emori because of the way he tried to trick his father with speech. But nevertheless, ultimately, Yaakov walked away with the blessings instead of Esau.
One other point about Shechem, you know, it later becomes the capital of the northern kingdom, and it's located in the land of Manasseh. A couple of points that I think about from the Torah associated with Shechem is in Genesis 37 and verse 13. You remember when Yosef is sent by Yaakov to find his brothers. Verse 13 says he's wandering in the field. He's at Shechem when this happens. And then, interestingly enough, in Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, it's at Shechem where the bones of Yosef are finally laid to rest. So there's this, there's almost, I don't know if I'm correct in saying this, but it seems like there's a word play when he says, I'm giving you one shoulder up on your brothers. It's Shechem. It could mean that, at least as I see it.
Now, speaking of word plays, here begins one of the most, I think, one of the most curious chapters in the Torah, chapter 49. And Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what will befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power." Starts off all right, this one for Reuben. And then it changes. And he says in verse 4, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." That's what it says. What goes through your mind, Ross?
You know, when you think about Reuven and some of these stories, obviously we know from the text that this actually happened. Reuven loses his spot, as do Simeon and Levi, because of their actions. Even though it says these are traditionally thought of as blessings, and it does say that in verse 28 of chapter 49, as you pointed out, these are not very lovely stories. In fact, aside from Judah and Joseph, most of these don't seem to be very blessing-like, if that makes sense.
Oh, I'll go with, Asher's not bad either. We'll talk about him in a little while.
All right, okay.
There's something very interesting that I heard, I think in the name of Reb Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. He was a great rabbi who lived in Germany in the 19th century. And he says like this. He says that it says over here that Israel was, that's Jacob, was going to gathering all his sons together, and he's going to bless them. And as you rightly point out, they don't look like blessings at all. In fact, they seem to be just a description of who Yaakov thinks these people are, he thinks of Reuben and what he thinks of Shimon and so on and so forth. He basically tells them an insight into who they are. And Reb Shamshon Raphael says like this. He says something beautiful. He says, "What is truly the greatest blessing in life? The greatest blessing in life is when somebody actually gets you, when somebody actually understands you." And so the biggest blessing that Yaakov could give his children was to say, "Look, I understand who you are. I actually get you." And to them, that was the greatest sense of satisfaction, having somebody who truly understood them. So I found that to be a beautiful insight.
So in that sense, then we're looking at this is Jacob just telling it like it is.
So in a sense, yes. Obviously, there's layers and layers and layers of interpretation. Each one of these things are filled with Torah pearls, as you call it, right? And in fact, you know, it says over here that I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end of days, but then ultimately, he doesn't end up telling Reuven what's going to be in the end of days or Shimon what's going to be in the end of days. He just seems to kind of go off onto something else. And the rabbinic commentary says that he did want to tell them the time of the arrival of the Messiah. He did want to tell them exactly when it's all going to happen, but God withheld that from him because he did not want the sons of Jacob to have that information at that point in time. He felt it was going to be to their detriment to know it, and therefore God withheld it from him, and so Yaakov just kept on with these blessings or statements, however you want to understand.
Mm-hmm. So it goes on to say in verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council, let not my honor be united to their assembly, for in their anger they slew a man, in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And that's, of course, again, referring back to the incident with Shechem.
Well, actually, the Midrash says on verse 6, and Rashi quotes it, that when it says about, and in Sodom, my soul should not come, it's referring to Zimri. We know the story with Cosby and Zimri. Zimri was the prince or the leader of the tribe of Simeon, and he was the one that committed that crime by fornicating with Cosby in front of all of Israel. And so when it speaks about who this Zimri was, it doesn't take him all the way back to Jacob. It just takes him back to Simeon, because Jacob had asked not to be associated with it. It says Zimri, the son of Salu, who was the prince of the house of Shimon, but it doesn't say the son of Yaakov.
Huh, interesting. Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down. He lies down as a lion. As a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. Ross, this is a line that we are very familiar with in the tradition that we came from.
Oh, absolutely.
Until Shiloh comes. Do you want to... What goes through your mind?
Well, a couple of things. One, sort of to reach back and grab a piece from the Joseph blessing, or from Judah and Joseph, to tie those together. I'm thinking, first of all, about 1 Chronicles 5. The sons of Reuven, the firstborn of Israel, he was firstborn, but when he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, or son of Israel, Joseph, so he's not reckoned as the firstborn. Though Judah, which we're talking about now, became more powerful than his brothers and a leader came from him, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph. Now, when you get into this and you see the passage where it says that we've learned one way and relearned a different, until he comes to Shiloh, in Hebrew, Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, I read once, we mentioned Gematria earlier, that the Gematria of that passage is, of that phrase, Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, is 358, which is the same as the Hebrew word Mashiach. Now, I think that this is also considered in Jewish circles a messianic passage, is it not, Rabbi Ely?
Yes, 100%.
Okay, and is that something that you've read in Jewish sources about the Gematria?
Yes. But I think what's often overlooked is when it speaks about the lawgiver between his feet. In other words, there's something over there where there's a promise that not only will the scepter, meaning the monarchy, not be removed from Judah, but even the lawgivers. And what this really refers to, in Jewish tradition at least, is that when we look through the passage of time where you have the leaders of the Jewish people in terms of teaching Torah especially in the land of Israel, it was usually the prince of the academy who, or the leader of the academy who was a descendant from King David. He was actually of royalty. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, known as Rebbe, was actually a descendant from the tribe of Judah, from the house of David. And so it wasn't just a matter of having this power and might and, you know, this sovereignty, but it was also a matter of being in a most respected position in terms of teaching Torah.
What one point, when we talk about Shiloh, Jonah, it just hit me. That would be a great place for a tour to bring like a busload of people, would it not?
I mean, that is definitely one place we will be going. One of my favorite places in Israel is the ancient is Shiloh. I love going there, and I look forward to going there again. It's just such a beautiful, peaceful place. In the mountains there, it's a great drive in the tour bus as well. I'm very much looking forward to that.
We can't guarantee that the Mashiach will be there at that time. We can say that we're going to Shiloh, right?
Well, look, think good and it will be good.
Okay. May it be. But it's all it's quite positive for Judah. It goes on to say, and to him shall be the obedience of the people, binding his donkey to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. Now, to me, that sounds pretty positive as well. I'd like to dwell by the haven of the sea.
Right.
He shall become a haven for ships, and his borders shall adjoin Sidon. Issachar, it's not so great for Issachar. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good and that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. Rabbi Eli, a band of slaves? What does that mean?
Actually, as negative as that might sound, it's actually positive. This burden refers to Torah, and you know when we look to the ethics of our fathers. It says something over there which is very important. It says that anybody who accepts upon himself the yoke of Torah, in other words, the burden to study Torah, and it doesn't mean burden in a negative sense that you look at it as a burden, but the burden meaning it's all consuming. It consumes time, it consumes your focus and everything. Then God says he removes from you the yoke of having to deal with the rest of the world. And mm-hmm. Yisachar was known to be the tribe who were actually dedicated to the study of Torah, and that's why it says Yisachar le'ahalecha, that Yisachar were very much in the tents. It was Zevulun that would go out and be merchants, and in fact we're told that the tribe of Zevulun and Yisachar went into a partnership where Yisachar and the members of that tribe would sit and study the Torah, and mm-hmm. their partners would be Zevulun because they would actually support them and offer them sustenance while they studied, and thereby they were actually taking part in the study of Torah because they were enabling them to actually sit and learn. And so, you know, when we talk about teachers in general, we know that the biggest slaves in society are teachers because mm-hmm. we are the slaves of our communities. Now, it doesn't have to mean slaves in a negative sense, but in the sense that, you know, we can't just shrug off the responsibility that we have to impart with to other people the knowledge that God has blessed us with. And so that's what this passage actually is referring to.
Well, that certainly puts it into a more positive light. Dan, you know what, Ross? I reckon Dan would be a great place to
You know, I was just thinking that'd be a wonderful place to go.
That'd be a great place to go. Tell Dan. I think that'd be wonderful. No, I've been there. Have you been there?
Absolutely. Yes, I've been twice. I think it's one of the most beautiful places There's a wonderful reserve there, and you can go to the headwaters of the Jordan. It is absolutely
crystal clear and gushing. It's just, yeah, it's a wonderful thing to behold, and some incredible history there. We're hoping to fit that in as well on the tour. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heel, so that the rider shall fall backward. And then we have this interesting little, seems like an interlude, Ross. What is this? I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Now, I've heard some interesting twists on that in the Messianic world.
Yes.
What do you think of?
I was actually thinking not of that interlude that you referred to, but, you know, in Christian tradition, there's this idea that Dan, I think in the, it's been a while since I read the material, but it seems that Dan is the one tribe that's missing in the book of Revelation. Do you remember if that's right?
Well, you know, I think you are right. When they read out, yeah, that's right, Dan's not there.
So, and I'm not trying to go there with this particular discussion, but there was a lot about the false Messiah coming from the tribe of Dan, and it was associated with people's interpretation of this particular passage,
really?
The association with the serpent and so forth.
What it really refers to is, we know that the descendant of Dan was actually Shimshon, Samson.
Yep.
Samson came from the tribe of Dan, and he was the judge. He was the one that went out and sought revenge for all that the Pelishtim, the Philistines, had done. And the verse that you speak of in verse 18 is actually a reference to the time when Samson asked God to remember him, when he said, "Remember me, God, and strengthen me just this one last time," after his eyes had been taken out, and that's when he brought down that whole house, and he said, "You know, let me die with the Philistines," and he took down the whole house, and says, we're told that more Philistines died on that day than had died throughout the entire lifetime of Samson.
Thousands.
And so this is where the descendant of Dan was hoping for God to come through with his plea to give him strength one more time, even though this was after his hair had been cut and his strength had been taken from him.
So Samson was a judge and a savior of the Jewish people.
That's correct.
Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. It says, now this is the way, I like this one. This is, and particularly in the New King James Study Bible here, I love the way they put it. Verse 20, bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. What do you reckon, Ross?
Well, my oldest grandson is named Asher. So I love that particular name, and I love that my oldest son chose that name for my first grandson. So anytime I think of Asher, one meaning of the Hebrew, as I understand it, Rabbi Eli, you can correct me. Does it typically, in this form, does it mean happy?
Asher generally means either happy or fortunate.
Yeah, so I like that. So that doesn't give us a lot of insight into the Torah, maybe, but it provides insight into my family. So how about that?
That's good. But doesn't it make perfect sense? I think if I had royal dainties, I'd be pretty happy. Naphtali is a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. Okay. And then we have, and this is obviously the icing on the cake, Joseph is a fruitful branch by a well. His branches run over the wall. The arches have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And then it says, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Now, there's a little bit of trickery in the text of the Christian translation. Of course, I have shepherd in the capital
yeah,
S.
Oh, yeah,
there it is. So it continues on, verse 25, by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, and blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Wow. So that's Joseph. Then he finishes it by saying, your brother Benjamin is a werewolf.
Yeah.
And that's all.
Well, you know, it's in the phrase where I think my translation in English says, on the top of the head of the one separate from his brothers. In Hebrew, that word is nazir. That particular phrase, nazir echav, is used twice. Once here in verse 26, and also in Deuteronomy 33, verse 16, which is Moses' blessing of Yosef. So I always, you know, I think about that. Yeah, he's separate from his brothers, but the word nazir tends to, at least in my mind, mean one who is set apart, you know, like a Nazirite. That's the root word there.
Okay, fair enough. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. And then it says, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them, and he blessed them, and he blessed each one according to his own blessing. There it is, the blessing of the sons of Jacob. And then he charged them, and he said to them, I am to be gathered to my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave, as you were talking about a little bit earlier, Ross, and so it was. And he eventually, Jacob had finished commanding his sons. He drew his feet up into the bed. He breathed his last and was gathered to his people. And then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants and physicians to embalm his father. Now, this is the first place, I think, that we see that someone is embalmed. Not that it wasn't happening before, but perhaps I don't think that Abraham, Rabbi Eli, I don't think Abraham was embalmed.
Right, no, but here it was a matter of embalming him to be able to take him up to the land of Israel and bury him there.
Oh, well, that's very fair, because it's a fairly warm and lengthy trip, and it would have been most unpleasant otherwise, right?
Yeah, so therefore that's the reason I think that he was embalmed.
It's interesting too. They spent 40 days on him, and the Egyptians mourned the death of Yaakov 70 days.
And it was huge. And they took him back to the land. And they buried him in the cave. Pharaoh gave him Joseph permission to go and bury your father as you said you would. And so they did. In chapter 50, is there anything that you would like to highlight?
Well, there's a few things that are interesting to point out. First of all, it was very important to Jacob that he should not remain in Egypt. And the question is why? I mean, what's so terrible to remain in Egypt? But we see from in chapter 50 that the Egyptians, you know, like you just mentioned, you know, they spent a long time mourning Jacob. And we have to wonder why did they spend so much time mourning him? And really what happened is that when Jacob came to the land of Egypt, the famine actually came to an end. So although it in the dream of Pharaoh, it was supposed to be 7 years of famine, it stopped early. It stopped early, if you do the calculation. It stopped a few years early because in honor of Jacob's arrival. And the Egyptians recognized that. And so they thought that there must be something very special. Now, what happens to special people in Egypt? Well, what happens to special people in Egypt is they become a god. And Jacob did not want to become a god. He did not want to be worshipped by anybody. And he recognized that this is the biggest abomination to God when a human being is venerated as anything more than a human being and exalted as something, anything more than a human being, as great as he might be. And therefore, he desperately wanted to leave the land. And you know what's interesting? It says in verse 6, and it says, and Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as you promised. And the commentary says, were it not for that promise that you gave your father, we'd never have allowed you to take him out. That's why it's specific, as you promised your father, because we would have preferred, the Egyptians would have preferred to keep him there and to create from him a deity
So are you saying that the reason why he wanted to be buried in the cave of his fathers is so that he would not be venerated in Egypt? Or is there something a little bit more significant about the pending resurrection, perhaps? Is there something in that as well? Ross, what are your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if it's any more significant, but I think about that dream that Yaakov has in Genesis 28, you know, the famous dream from Vayetze. And one of the things that he's told by God is that the land on which you're lying, I'll give it to you and to your seed. Your seed will be like the dust of the earth. You'll expand to the west and the east and the north and the south, and all the families on earth will be blessed through you and through your seed. And then it says in verse 15, I love this passage, and here I am with you, and I'll watch over you everywhere that you'll go, everywhere. And I'll bring you back to this land, for I won't leave you until I've done what I've spoken to you. So in one of the things that I think about is it's almost as if because of this promise, he has to be brought back to the land that was promised in this passage, in this dream in Vayetze. He's got to be brought back to the land.
Mm-hmm. And so I agree with that. And there's two parts, really. There's one part of being brought back to the land of Israel and another part of not being kept in Egypt.
Left.
Those are two issues.
Yeah, gotcha.
And when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. And so they sent messages to Joseph saying, before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sins, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of your servants of the God of your fathers. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we are your servants. Again, another fulfillment of the dreams that he had right at the beginning of this saga. And Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. That's beautiful.
I was just thinking in that particular passage you just read, he says to his brothers, because they're clearly worried, you thought it bad, God thought it good. And then this, the way that ends, it says literally he spoke upon their heart. It's such a touching story. It's like he's weeping. He's like, no way, I'm not going to hold this against you. God meant all this to preserve life, and then he speaks to their heart. I think that's a really moving passage in the Torah.
So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110. He was 110. Rabbi Eli, I mean, that's nowhere near as close as old as his father lived.
Well, it's interesting that the commentaries say that Yosef was really supposed to live 120 years, but 10 years were taken off his life. And the reason for that is because when the brothers came down to Egypt and they spoke to Joseph, they referred to Jacob, his father, as your servant. And they did that 10 times. And in none of those instances does Jacob object to them saying and calling Jacob his servant. And because of that, 10 years was taken off his life for not objecting to the calling of Jacob as your servant.
And that's the understanding there. Well, yeah, I mean, 110, but it does say, at least in 23, that Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, who were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. And then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and they put him in a coffin. Now, here this ends our Torah portion, but here we see that he also is embalmed, but he's not taken away. He's put in a coffin in Egypt, Rabbi Eli, and yet he pleads with them, make sure you promise to me that when you go, because we know that you will go, it is prophesied that you will go, take me with you. The significance, again, perhaps to avoid he being deified?
Well, yeah, but one of the questions that stick out over here is that, you know, there's a principle of trying to end on a good note, on a happy note. Mm-hmm. And here we're ending the whole book of Genesis as, you know, with Joseph dying and him being buried in Egypt. And what's so good about that? But the truth of the matter is that Joseph being buried in Egypt served as a great strength and encouragement to the Jewish people, for he's the one that promised them that God will surely take them out. And the fact that he was still in Egypt with the Jewish people throughout their time in Egypt, that served as a tremendous strength to them to keep their faith in the promises that God made to Abraham, that he would ultimately take the Jewish people out of Egypt and that they would leave with great riches and be brought into the land of Israel. So it does, in a sense, end on a positive note, only in the sense that that Yosef did not leave up to Israel like Jacob did, but he stayed together with his brothers. And in a way, he took responsibility for them, to be there for them throughout that exile, and ultimately they didn't leave Egypt without taking Joseph with him.
That's one of the things that I love about the Exodus story, is that it's mentioned in Tor Portion Beishalach in Exodus 13, verse 19. It says, "And Moses took Joseph's bones with him, because he had had the children of Israel swear, saying, God will take account of you, and you'll bring up my bones from here with you." So the Torah connects the dots, if you will, and the promise is fulfilled. And as the children of Israel leave Egypt, they cannot leave Yosef. He accompanies them, his bones accompany them on the journey back to the land.
Thank you, gentlemen. It has been an absolute wonderful privilege to have both of you on Truth to You doing Torah Pearls. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, John.
I have to say, everyone, I forgot to mention at the beginning, and everyone's saying, well, that's all very well and good, and thank you, Ross, and thank you, Rabbi Eli. What happened to Tovia and what happened to Jason? Well, it is New Year's, you know, I mean, you know, they're party animals. I mean, who knows where they are and what they're doing? No, that's not true. No, Tovia is coming down with a little bit of a cold. He's actually in Jerusalem. It would have been great to speak to him. We'll speak to him next week, and I'm sure he'll be better by then. Jason has just returned from a trip to Scotland. I'm looking forward to catching up with him to see how that went down. But as I said, it is the holiday season, and tying three different time zones together is very, very difficult. So thank you, gentlemen, for coming onto the program with such short notice. A reminder to the listeners, Ross Nichols of rootsoffaith.org. Rootsoffaith.org. You and I, my friend, and Tovia Singer are going to the land in November 2015. We're here in 2000. Well, I'm here in 2015. What time is it there, Ross?
I have 45 minutes to get home and celebrate
before you turn into a pumpkin.
2015. That's right.
Okay, before you turn into a pumpkin, you got to do that. Rootsoffaith.org and Rabbi Eli Cohen, the website is jewsforjudaism.org.au. I will put a link on this post where you can also make a donation to Jews for Judaism in Australia. And it's wonderful news that now you have an office in Bondi. And what a wonderful place to have an office. I think that's good. So thank you again, gentlemen. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Thank you.